You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to Table Talk, a guide to the future of food and nutrition, brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we chat with visionaries from across the food industry to discover the ideas that will transform our food landscape. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, broadcaster, and all-round gastronaut. Now, imagine you're an up-and-coming brand just starting up in the food industry. What are the ingredients to achieving success as a future brand? Well, today we're going to find out by hearing from the winners of the 2021 Food Matters Future Brand Awards and by talking with two of the judges about their own journey to success and about the advice that they can offer. I'm really pleased to say that with me today are the judges Emma Williams, Head of Future Brands, Origination and Investing at Sainsbury's. Hi, Emma.
Hello.
Thank you for coming and joining us. And we've also got Andy Wardlaw, Chief Ideas Officer at MMR Research.
Stephen, hello.
Great to see you. Now, let's just start with you, Andy. You lead the insight and ideas at MMR Research with the aim of helping clients create a more powerful user experience. Can you tell me what does that mean and what are the implications of it?
Yeah, well, I can tell you why there is a need for more powerful experiences. I mean, when you think about it, we are now living in a world where there's so much to occupy and distract people. We are all surfing, streaming, gaming, social media, etc. So there's what's known as, of course, there's the attention deficit economy. And it's been said that now every company, every brand in the world is competing against every other company and brand in the world. So, I mean, I think it's a realization that for everyday food and drink and grocery products generally, there is a need to up the ante to create experiences. And this ultimately dials back to, you know, those sort of heightened sensory experiences that we remember. And there are some great examples in the food industry, like, you know, the first sip of a Guinness, the moment you bite into a Magnum, even the sound that bottle of Grolsch makes when you open it. So
you know, it's morning, it's those little moments of theatre, and you've got really me salivating already.
Yeah. So I think we've got to find ways for everyday products in the supermarket to just add that little bit of theatre to people's lives. And yeah, particularly at a time like now.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, now Emma, you lead the origination of future brands at Sainsbury's. I mean, it sounds like an enormously powerful role, and that you can make a difference between success or failure of brands. What does your role entail on a day-to-day basis?
So, I mean, it's a very exciting role, and it makes it sound very kind of leader style of make or break, but we don't try and break dreams too often. But I think there's no real kind of typical day to day, but the Future Brands team at Sainsbury's was really set up to find the best brands to partner with exclusively and then really try and turbocharge the growth of these challenger brands within Sainsbury's. And as head of origination of Future Brands, my team is responsible for finding exclusive brands that help Sainsbury's build fantastic differentiated ranges and gives customers also more reasons to shop with us. So my team and I are looking for brands that can really disrupt categories or tap into new trends and missions where we see that there is the headroom for growth. And there's obviously so many different elements that we do consider for the make or break. And there are many different brilliant teams that we interact with on a daily basis across Sainsbury's to make things happen. Like I said, there's not really a typical day. And I'd spend my time between meetings with brand owners, with venture capitalists, understanding sort of where the money is coming and going, hosting and attending panel events on trends, researching trends, attending now virtual trade shows to discover new brands, and meeting with our trading teams and internal stakeholders, understanding our performance data of our brands and what kind of customers that they are attracting. The role, to be honest, is really varied. And that's one of the things I absolutely love about my role and my team.
Well, this is why we're really excited to have both you and Andy with us. And throughout this episode, you'll be giving advice about what makes a successful brand and about what you've seen. And also, I'd like to know how people are going to negotiate this whole idea of online trade shows, because it must be very difficult for some people. But first of all, let's dive into some of the winners from the 2021 awards. Let's hear an interview with John Walsh, the CEO of Bio&Me, who were the gold winners in this year's UK Challenger Brands. Now, John was working in a dairy when he met his business partner, Dr. Megan Rossi, a health expert, and he saw an opportunity.
I spent quite a long time trying to persuade her quite how hard it is to start your own business, etc., which turns out to be true. But she just, her passion for gut health and her commitment to it just convinced me. I mean, I'm convinced that she is the leading expert in the UK. She knows what she's talking about. The trend of gut health is just so strong. We went across to one of the biggest trade shows, Expo West in the States, and we could just see there the gut health market booming. We just thought, look, this is the right time. So, you know, we jumped in, and, you know, 2 years of very, very hard work later, here we are. What advice would I give to a young, innovative person? Take the weekend to really, really think about, do you want to do it? And then if you do, and you are prepared to give up evenings and weekends, and, you know, genuinely you would rather work than, you know, either go to the pub or go for a run with your friends or whatever it might be, you know, for those first few years while you set it up, you know, if you are genuinely committed, then do it, because there's nothing better.
Quite a sobering moment there, isn't it? He's literally talking about the weight of responsibility and challenge. So, Andy, now, like Emma, you were on the Future Brands panel. What is it? What's at the heart of this? What makes a great challenger in food and drink categories?
Well, I think it starts. It can start in a number of areas. Whether it's a sort of response to consumer activism, you know, all of this. Saving the world or food waste, etc. But I think in this case, it was a personal story from you know, its originators about creating a breakfast that really did start the day from a gut health perspective well. And you know, it's been developed without, I think, the hitting price points, etc. It's been developed for what is good for the body. And the product that we've tried, it is just amazing. It's from the very first moment you pick it up, you get that sense of nutrition density. It's quite a heavy weight to the pack, to the size. So that's an unexpected early sensory cue that this is nutrition dense. And the product talks a really good game when it comes to its nutrition story. So it introduces us to the idea of nutrition diversity. And all of the, I think most products have at least 15 or 16 diverse plant-based ingredients. And these are all backed by the EFSA approved health claim, which, you know, really does sort of seal their story off rather nicely. But, you know, it's not just about the hype. The product, as we tried it, really delivered from that very first moment of truth, you know, when you pick the package up.
And so as they develop and as they become stronger and more and frankly sell more products, when does that challenge or challenger become a serious threat to the established brands that are already there?
Well, I think these brands often get listed with, you know, the Selfridges, the Ocados, the Planet Organics of this world. And in that time, they're often bought by the early adopters. But I think it's when the malts start taking an interest, including, of course, Sainsbury's. And I would imagine that Sainsbury's likes to know that there is some evidence of a repeat rate here, that the product really performs, because it stands or falls by, you know, the product delivery. You know, challengers can often be very good with funky language and positionings and graphics and packaging. But if the product falls, then there may be a short-term fad as an outcome. So I think, yes, when you get those, the multiples involved, that's when it starts to become a serious threat. And in my view, one of the advantages, I think, that a challenger brand has is that they're often all over the branding, the packaging, and the product. So what they can create is very much done holistically. It all seems to hang together.
Hmm.
And I think as, you know, companies get bigger and packaging is developed in this building here and products tested in another building there and developed, that's when things start to become a little piecemeal and it just loses that impact, you know, that the whole being greater than the sum of its parts.
Yeah. Yeah.
The challenges have the advantage.
Yeah. So, okay, Emma. So, I mean, Andy's talked about stories, since that everything gels, but is there a gold dust at the heart? Yeah. You know, I want to launch a new brand at the moment. What would you tell me that there is what is the gold dust at the heart of this that I need to find and dig out? Or is that a little bit too shallow a way of thinking?
I think it's a $1 million question. And, you know, Andy said, the amount of competition in the market is absolutely huge. So there is work for new brands and challenger brands to be able to get that cut through versus all the many hundreds of thousands of products. I think something that we've really seen a shift in, though, is that as customers, we're all used to seeing older, bigger branded players in every store we go into. And in particular, younger customers and millennials want to try something new. They want to see something cause or mission led that's really different and exciting. And of course, it's not completely straightforward to be able to get that new, different appeal. And that's one of the reasons our team exists in Sainsbury's. I think definitely understand where Andy's coming from. You know, you see that translation from Planet Organics and Whole Foods, and then maybe a proven track record through a D2C business, and then launching the multiples then really gives brands that airtime, I guess.
Hmm.
I'd say the thing that I feel is really at the heart of a lot of the successful brands that we work with, sounds really basic, is the proposition. That's kind of the hygiene factor, that the product and the pricing, they're incredibly important. And without getting these right, you really don't have any hope.
Those are the two starting points, really, aren't they?
Yeah.
Don't get those right, and nothing's going to follow.
It sounds so simple, but there's so many brands who have a fantastic, delicious product, and it's branded beautifully, but the pricing is completely out of kilter with the rest of the subcategory that it's competing with. And you just can't expect a customer to kind of spend that much more for something new and different. So obviously, that sounds very simple, but we see a lot of people get it wrong.
And do you get a lot of brands who say, yeah, but look at what we've got here. You know, they're bound to pay that much more because look at the thing.
Yeah, all the time. And I think that's one of the things that we tend to come back to is, you know, customers vote with their wallets, and you really need to have that customer insight and proof of success to know that you know your customer. It's very well and good, you know, surveying people and saying, would you pay for this? But when they're actually in a store and comparing it to the next kind of best products,
yeah,
it can often be a very different story. So I think the data-led insight of knowing a customer is super important. But Andy's touched on it slightly. The other like additional factors, obviously, that help get that cut through is about brand experience.
Mm.
And really, how will a customer remember your product, and will they go and buy it again? We want to have brands in stores that sell well because our customers love them and will buy them in their basket every single time. But I do think that one of the most advantageous things that smaller brands have versus the bigger players is their agility. And they do have agility to innovate faster. There's less red tape. And they can respond to changing trends or demand and get great product in front of customers much quicker.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with that, Emma. And I think maybe, you know, they're not chained to those vast sums of capex on a production line that makes things in a certain format. So they've not got that inertia. And I guess with any company that's been in a category for a long period of time, they see the category through a certain lens, don't they? And then somebody comes along with a completely new format, or, you know, removing a key ingredient that nobody really liked. And then suddenly we look at the category through a completely different lens. They are able to reimagine the category because they haven't got that ball and chain of inertia or capex.
Yeah, absolutely. Now we've got so much to ask you, but let's hear from another one of our winners right now. This is Johnny Barnes, the founder of the Soho Juice Company, which picked up the Silver Award. Johnny told us that they had a few bumps along the way.
We learned the hard way. If you put one cucumber in a blender, it's this brilliant green. If you put 500 in a really big industrial size blender, they turn a dark brown. Someone politely described it to us as looking healthy looking. And then we also got the weight wrong because we included cucumber skins as part of the weight. And we didn't really know at the time, but a gherkin is a pickled cucumber. And so we're also sitting on a ticking time bomb of gherkin juice. And so we had to reformulate it, and we did. And again, with the help of Chester University, and then we started to contract manufacture the bottles with two flavors at the time. But we were then looking more at the mixer angle because of the gap. But we had bottles, which were also 200 mils, but the overwhelming feedback was, this is a brilliant product. We love the taste, but this should be a soft drink.
Do you find that people will start with that idea in one place and then change it, sometimes fundamentally? And is that a mark of success or failure, or is it just the natural evolution of a brand?
I think it can be a little bit of both. And I think some of it comes back to, do you understand your customer? And if you, either you do or you don't, you could understand your customer, but your customer changes over time. What becomes important to them changes over time. Or you don't know your customer, and then you do have to completely pivot what you are selling, so that actually you have people who are going to pick it up and put it in their baskets. I wouldn't say that either one is necessarily success or failure. I think the success is having the ability to be able to change your proposition in line with what your customers want, and not just sticking to, I see this gap and I think this will work. Because at the end of the day, like I said, you need to have customers vote with their wallets. So being respondent and having that data-led view is paramount.
The big established brands, do they hate you? Are you basically the personification of everything that's dangerous to them? And are they pitching sort of pseudo independent brands at you to try and catch your eye?
Yeah, I mean, hate's a strong word, and I really hope they don't hate us. My team and I, we work with predominantly challenger brands and the smaller brands in the market. But we do also work with brands that have got, great track record in D2C, and we're their first retailer listing. And we additionally work with FMCGs, where they might have brands that they've acquired that have been really successful in other countries, for example, in the US. And then they want to test their new brand and product that they've acquired in the UK. So we do work across the whole spectrum, but with the majority being in the challenger brand space. But I think the important thing is that, we're looking for brands that can disrupt or that have great headroom for growth. And that's what drives all of the decisions of the brands that we work with. I wouldn't say they hate us.
Yeah, they say they like you.
But I think ultimately, Emma, what you're doing is you're helping categories reinvent themselves, because you're helping these challengers who aren't looking at things through a different lens get, their foot on the ladder. And if categories don't reinvent themselves, they die.
And hopefully those ideas become contagious.
Yeah, and it does disrupt, and, it raises the bar for the rest of the category. Mm. And I think some of the things that we've seen do really well are actually disruptive brands. We've had a brand, Capsicana, that does Mexican meal kits, and sorry Andy, but they do disrupt with Old El Paso.
And Old El Paso will have to respond to that and up its game, and the consumer wins,
The consumer wins.
Okay, well, let's look at the current status of how brands get through. Andy, the pandemic's changed people's shopping habits. Far more people now getting their groceries online. How has this affected the market for future brands, but also for brands selling themselves to each other? And Emma mentioned online trade shows and things earlier on. I mean, has everything changed, and has anything become better?
Well, yeah, we know, of course, that there's been a massive shift in the last 12, 14 months online. And my view is that this will really favor the challenger brands of this world. I see the internet as a great leveler. So a small challenger brand with a good sidekick in web development can create a pretty good impression online. There's a famous case study with Lucky Saint, the sort of challenger low alcohol beer that is the number two seller on Amazon in beer. And they've made a great store within a store. So it can be done. I think the challenge for these new brands, of course, will be about how to drive trial, because people will not have tried their products before. So they've got to find a way of writing or through video or graphics to try and build that confidence with the consumer that this product, tastes great, basically, because they haven't got the benefit of people having tried them before. But definitely the move online is going to mean that challenger brands are, leveling the stakes with the bigger brands, because of course there are no sort of limits on shelf space, etc.
Yeah, it's quite exciting, isn't it? And Emma, you mentioned the online trade shows, the pitching of brands. How have you seen the nature of that develop?
So it's really interesting. I think about 12 months ago, actually, when I started this role, I never expected that I would be doing trade shows virtually online. Yeah. And I think that event organisers have responded incredibly well to be able to do something in the absence of being able to get together. I think it's a great opportunity because it does mean that people can dial in from their desks and aren't travelling all over the place to see different brands and to be able to showcase equally. But I think the flip of that is you book in for a session with certain people. You're not wandering around a table. If it's different when something catches your eye and you can just wander over rather than booking a slot for 10 minutes and it's an online virtual pitch.
But in the same way, I guess the consumer themselves are if they're doing it online, they're not going to have it in front of them as well. So
yeah,
it's a sort of similar pitch, really, isn't it?
I think it's a really good learning experience. And to Andy's point with that, it is a great opportunity to be able to learn how to, present in a virtual way so that it is, eye-catching to not only a retailer like myself, but as a customer. So I think it has its pros and cons, but I'm certainly looking forward to a bit more, interaction with brands in person rather than over a screen.
You want to feel a package, don't you?
And yeah, I do.
That wasn't meant to sound quite like that. But you want to be able to get to grips with the. the packaging itself and the feel of it is part of the sell, isn't it? Now, Three Spirit Drinks won the Bronze Award, and their founder Dash Lilly spoke about the importance of collaboration.
Three Spirit began by getting some of the world's best bartenders and plant scientists around the same table. Those people don't come together often, so we tried to instigate that collaboration, that exchange of expertise and experience. And it was a lot of fun. What it basically meant is a lot of tasting and experimenting with hundreds of different raw materials and plant ingredients for taste and effect, guinea pigging ourselves, creating things and getting feedback from various people on how effective they were, how good they were from a taste perspective. And we developed from there again and again. We're a direct-to-consumer focused business, so we've managed to create our own audience and customer base through our website digitally. That's been very helpful. It means that we know our customers very well. We get lots of feedback. We know what we're doing well. We know what we can improve on. And so, to be honest, we were kind of blown away with the speed of how we grew.
So that's a very interesting angle to take on it. But before we dive into a little bit more about the tips and the tricks, I'd like to know a bit more about Andy and Emma. Andy, you started in the food industry a while back, and there's a little bit of a fishy story there, isn't there?
Yeah, I see what you've done there. Yeah, I it's almost 30 years, Stefan. That scares me. Where when I started as a territory sales rep for a company called Shippums, and they made meat and fish paste. And I was out there with my car full of fish paste selling to Book of Cash and Carries and small independents. And yeah, I might knock it a little, but I got a good classical sales training, you know, negotiation skills. And you get that first experience of the buyer-seller relationship, really. And it's where you learn a hell of a lot about the trade. I mean, I learned really early on about the power of display. So anytime there was a promotion on fish paste at, say, Booker, I'd be there building my fish paste pyramid displays.
Oh,
and the stuff shifted, you know? you know, all this stuff around mental, physical availability, you know, from Ehrenberg Brass. Now, I was there, you know, 30 years ago with my fish paste pyramids.
Yeah. And I guess also for challenger brands, these sort of things are really important because, above all, you're selling. You know, you're selling this stuff. You might be, you know, hipster, you know, with the right coffee, but you've got to flog this stuff at the end of the day as well. So sales is really important, isn't it?
It is, and making sure that the shelves look neat and tidy and well stocked. I think people like to buy from well stocked shelves, you know, not from dusty. So a part of my job was dusting, you know, merchandise in Londises, et cetera, like that, to make it look, you know, fresh and new and attractive.
Yeah, and there's lots to learn from that. And then you went on to support several brands at General Mills. Can you tell us about that?
I did. Well, you know, through you know, mergers and acquisitions, Shippums was swallowed by Grammet Foods, which was merged with Pillsbury, which was then amalgamated with General Mills. So, you know, before I knew it, I was looking after brands like Old El Paso and Häagen-Dazs. So quite a stretch there from fish-based. But, you know, when I think about it, I've seen in the inception of category management, which was like quite something in the late 1990s. It was the idea that you weren't just looking after your own interests, but the good of the category.
Yeah.
And of course, the race was on to be category captain at that point, you know, to be the authority, but still, you know, to be doing the right thing for the category. And then later, consumer insight. Yeah.
So, Emma, what got you interested in the food industry right at the beginning?
So my experience is a little bit different to Andy's. When I left university, I started on the grad scheme at KPMG, went on that well-trodden path of training to be a chartered accountant, and once qualifying, subsequently went into management consulting. And I always found that the most interesting clients and companies that I worked with were those with something tangible that they provided. And I worked with a fair few retail clients. One of my last clients in consulting before moving to Sainsbury's was actually Tesco, which I always got a big boo from when I moved to Sainsbury's. But I've always had a really keen interest in retail. And I suppose that, coupled with a natural interest in food and trying new things, led me into grocery retail. And I really wanted to be in the thick of it, on the kind of client side within a business, rather than advising from the outside that I had done at the start of my career. So it's been great being on the other side, seeing projects through to completion and seeing a real difference in delivery of financials or to changes of ways of working, for example.
And you then went to work in the strategy team at Sainsbury's, is that right?
Yeah, so I joined in the strategy team at Sainsbury's. I joined in 2017, it was and is a brilliant team where I was able to use my background and skills from accounting and consulting to really add value. And during my time in the team, I worked on a mixture of different projects. So some M&A deal activity, including the Nectar acquisition and the Asda deal, as well as then focusing on growth strategies for some of our key trading categories. So I learned a huge amount about Sainsbury's in quite a short space of time, about our operations across various different projects that I worked on. I absolutely loved it. And actually, one of the things that led me to where I am now is that during a project, I spent some time focusing on how Sainsbury's was working with and supporting smaller suppliers to launch in retail. And so I worked closely with the Future Brands team as it was just starting. And I found the team incredibly exciting from that moment on. And a year or so later, the role that I'm currently in came up and I just knew I had to go for it.
Mm. It just sounds like the most exciting job at Sainsbury's, to be honest, from where I'm sitting. How do people get hold of you? You must be inundated with products and people calling and wanting to pitch to you. What's the thing that cuts through that makes you go, all right, I might give them a shout?
Yeah, I get absolutely inundated with contact, as do my team, over any form you can imagine. I think it comes back to this point of how do you stand out virtually? How do you stand out online? And usually it's the emails or contact that is short, sharp, concise, to the point. And really, as much as selling, as much as the founder selling their own brand to me, I want them to sell to me why they think it will sell in Sainsbury's. So understanding the Sainsbury's customer and the Sainsbury's strategy and why it will fit within our existing ranges. If that is given to me in a really easy format, it's just kind of tick, tick, tick. Okay, I can see that you're helping me sell it. So that's kind of the first unlocker for me. But yeah, I don't give my email address out freely. And it's something that we all get inundated with. But we've had some fantastic brands that have come through being inundated. So, it's definitely not a negative.
So you've touched on something here that I think is really fascinating, and that's, what is it that people don't do? What are the marks of not necessarily failure, but people that can't cut through? Is it that they're not doing their research, that they're not grounding their pitch in something that means something to you?
Yeah, that's really quite spot on, actually. It's often in the way that a brand is being pitched. So either it's a long rambling pitch or long rambling email or meeting with no clear takeaways, or it's not grounded in data and it doesn't show that there is kind of a proof of success or why this has been created, what's the gap that it's addressing. Mm. And for my team and I, we work across all food and non-food grocery categories in Sainsbury's, so we cover a huge variety of different products. So it just makes our lives easier if someone can say, this is who I am, this is why I fit, and this is why I'm going to do a great job in Sainsbury's. Mm. And that's really what it comes back to.
Back to the elevator pitch, really. If you can, yeah, tell me in as few words as possible, then the story is that much stronger. Andy, what about you? What are the marks of failure that you've seen that you could have guided people around?
Well, there's often that reliance, isn't there, on the packaging and the idea, but the product just somehow feels ordinary. You know, there isn't a there's nothing memorable to it, and as a result, it just falls by the wayside. You know, it has to be the whole thing. Mm. And as I've said before, I think the advantage that challengers have is they can have a real input into all elements of the brand, the user experience. So if it's simply a copy of what is out there at the moment, but maybe in some funkier style packaging, I think the consumer will find them out that there's nothing really remarkable to this. Because challenger brands do often raise consumers' expectations, the fact that they're a challenger. So, what are they doing differently? The fact that they've got some new format or funky graphic that does raise expectations. And if they are not met with the product experience, the consumption experience, then they have further to fall.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's hear from one more of our winners. This is the winner of the International Challenger Brand, and that was Bites We Love. Their founder, Marlene Bassart, spoke about what she'd wish she'd known when she started the business.
I mean, I think the most important thing is make sure you surround yourself with the right people. I've been very lucky that about 4 years ago, my current business partner joined our business, which, is amazing. I think we make up such a good team because we're very complementary in skills. And I think it's very good to have somebody in your team who also points out when you're not right. When you're running your own business, it's good to have people that, give you feedback and help you grow your business, but also yourself sort of personally. And second of all, what I found very important in building our brand here in the Netherlands is that you need to find customers or partners, like retail partners, that are willing to build your brand together, right? So that are like a supermarket partner or a food service partner that's actually willing to share data with you on development of sales, you know, who is buying your products, and that is willing to give you some time to build your brand.
Okay, in the last section here, we're going to do some sort of quite quick, short, sharp Q&As to see if we can really kind of hit the core of what a new future brand needs. So, Emma, a big part of future brands is finding the opportunity itself. What gaps, are there gaps in the market anymore? I mean, with tens of thousands of products on the shelves, are there gaps in the market, or are there areas that you think you're interested in developing?
Yeah, so there's always going to be gaps in the market. There's the evolution of what customers are looking for, different trends, different ingredients, different science that's coming out that creates new products. I think it's not necessarily about the gaps, it's the disruption that we've spoken about as well. I see the next year being really interesting in regards to changing regulations with HFSS. There's obviously still some uncertainty of what it will mean and how the regulations will play out, but it's presented huge challenges to many big brands and products, but it can be really seen as an opportunity for smaller brands to play in this space and to play into the be better space versus the mainstay competitors. I think that's going to be really exciting over the next year.
That's interesting to keep an eye out for regulations, which is not the normal way that you would approach building a new brand, but it should really work. Andy, trends that you foresee in the coming months and years?
Well, isn't everything up in the air at the moment? I think we can predict that people will be living more home-based lifestyles in future. So, you know, what does a night out look like indoors? I think we've all been following the science with regards to health, haven't we, for the past 12 or so months? So will health become less holistic and more hard-edged? You know, so more scientifically proven products. So yeah, there is, we don't quite know what's going to stick yet, but I think we can be pretty sure that I think health is going to get more hard edged. So I think that's going to lead to a lot of new products. Yeah.
Okay. Now imagine I'm the CEO of a new brand, Emma. Now, when I started out in the film industry, we used to send out my CV and it would, fall on the desk of somebody who had 50 other CVs. And after the first couple of months of nobody calling me back, I then started stapling a curly whirly to the bottom of the letter. And then literally everyone who got my CV called me back. The CV wasn't any different. I was still the same person. But is there one thing, is there one little bit of advice that would help people stand out in the market? Stapling a curly whirly is a gimmick, but it did work.
I love that idea of stapling a curly whirly. I'd actually say, so there's three things I'd say, but they're very interrelated. So first is spend time getting to know your customer. Second, adapt, respond to feedback from your customers and make changes to improve the proposition as you go. And third, share that data-driven insight with any prospective retailers. Help us sell you.
Mm-hmm, I like that. Okay, and Andy, any top tips from you? Some really basics that would really help boost a new brand.
Well, if you're developing a new brand, I think, is there a way in which you can elevate its value in terms of, you know, how investors think about it as well as consumers? By thinking about the tech side of things. So there are businesses out there, for example, like in vitamins and minerals that are using 3D printers to print your personalized vitamins. It's not just about the vitamins, it's also the tech, and positioning themselves as a tech as well as a food business is, I think, one way to move ahead quite rapidly, certainly in the amount of capital you're able to raise as well.
Yeah, and right now that's a big deal. Well, thank you both for all of your help. And it's such a privilege to get your insight. You've been listening to Andy Wardlaw and Emma Williams. Thank you so much for both of you for joining us today. It has been brilliant and fascinating. And I really hope we're going to revisit this, because I know that there are so many people who are just desperate for this information. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts, in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from sustainable salmon to meat-free steaks. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Thanks so much for listening.